Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the up to 5 million missing emails from the White House's service, which, of course, operate under the Presidential Records Act, where everything is supposed to be archived and preserved. And there is an expectation or a sense that the number of emails involving the activities of Karl Rove are missing. We'll be speaking with the investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times who's been covering this story. Tom Hamburger will be joining us. And he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 1996. Previously, he was with the Wall Street Journal, Minneapolis Star Tribune, and the Arkansas Gazette. And he recently broke the story in the LA Times that perhaps about the millions of missing emails in connection with the White House's role in this growing scandal over the fired U.S. attorneys. He's also co-author of One Party Country with Peter Walston. And we'll be talking about the subprime lenders meltdown with Paul Leonard, who's the California director of the Center for Responsible Lending. And Mr. Leonard is a long-time advocate for full disclosure and responsibility and accountability in the lending industry. And, of course, there is an expectation that up to 400,000 homes in California will be foreclosed on this year and 2.4 million in the United States. So we'll be talking about that, and then we'll be joined in the studio by Dr. Richard Malika, who's a Harvard Medical School professor of psychiatry and director of the Harvard Program on Refugee Trauma at the Massachusetts General Hospital. And we're talking to him about his book, Healing Invisible Wounds, Paths to Hope and Recovery in a Violent World. I'm now speaking with Tom Hamburger, who is investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, specializing in the White House and executive branch. And he was a finalist for the Pulitzer in 1998, and he is the co-author with Peter Walston of One Party Country. And Tom, there's apparently 5 million missing emails. Is that right?
Well, that's one of the numbers that's been thrown around. The reality, Ian, is that no one really knows how many are missing. There are a couple of different categories or a couple of different glitches that we know that the White House has acknowledged has occurred. At one point from the podium, a White House spokesman said, yes, it could be that high. We just don't know.
Well, of course, the chair of the Senate Oversight Committee, Senator Leahy, has all but called the White House liars. He's basically saying that they're coming up with my dog ate the homework excuses here. So he's saying, demanding, he said they exist. Then he insists that they exist.
Yes, he said any teenager could recover lost emails, and that may be a bit of an exaggeration. Apparently, the technical experts say it really is very difficult to permanently erase an email record, not only because they can be recovered from computer hard drives, but also because they're stored on servers often and backup tapes. And we expect, and the White House has said they're working on recovering these lost emails and that they expect that some will be recovered.
Well, of course, we know Oliver North learned to his chagrin that this early emails, the prof notes that he deleted, mm-hmm. eventually recovered. And, of course, one person who really should know was Bill Gates. And all of his emails detailing their internal antitrust activities eventually surfaced to his embarrassment. So, but the RNC's servers are the ones that are really in question here, are they not? Isn't it clear that Karl Rove was using the RNC, his RNC accounts, as were others, to avoid the Presidential Records Act?
Well, Ian, what is going on in this case is really the collision or the intersection of two different laws.
The Hatch Act, right.
One is the Hatch Act, which generally prohibits use of government resources for political activities. And it's that law that inspired the Bush administration, following a lead the Clinton administration had taken before them, to provide a small number of White House officials whose jobs included interaction with political groups and helping the president arrange campaign visits and even fundraising, access to private party accounts. The idea was to separate the overtly political campaign-related things from the obviously official acts, which must be, according to the Presidential Records Act, generally recorded and maintained for use by historians, and because they must be maintained, they could also be used by investigators. It appears now that what's happened is that Karl Rove and about 50 others in the White House since 2001 who were designated in a special category of sort of mixed political and official relied overly heavily on their political email accounts, even for official work. And we've seen a couple of instances that surfaced in this investigation of the U.S. attorneys and in a couple of other investigations in which political accounts were used to communicate matters which seem quite plainly to have to do with official business. And that's where the problem lies.
And could this be explained by the broader criticism that's been leveled against this administration from the very beginning, starting with the first head of the faith-based initiative, John DiIulio, who basically said, this White House doesn't do policy, they only do politics, followed by O'Neill and Dick Clark and others, basically saying this is a politically driven White House. So it shouldn't be a surprise if that's true.
Well, I think that we are seeing that these internal emails and the extent to which the White House, 50 people in the White House, relied on servers and email accounts maintained by the Republican National Committee does provide some insight into the extent of politicization of traditional government activities that this White House has engaged in. And of course, when we broke some of the first stories of Karl Rove presenting campaign-related information to department managers in some of the executive branch agencies, the response was, we're shocked that politics is going on in the White House or among political appointees. Well, of course, politics has always gone on in the White House and in among political appointees. Where there does seem to be a historic difference in this administration, it gets to the degree of politicization and the extent to which it reaches into government agencies, including areas where politics was once, if not entirely removed, at least kept at a respectable distance. And one of the places where you're seeing that erupt currently, and we're going to see a lot about it this week, is in the area of hiring and firing of U.S. attorneys.
And, of course, there was recently, I think it was Waxman's committee was looking into a PowerPoint presentation that Rove and others conducted for federal employees that was overtly political.
Yes, and this is something that that interests me a great deal because I think it does tell you something about, again, the degree of politicization. Under the Clinton, I spoke for a story I was working on earlier in the week with Doug Sosnick, who ran the political office for several years under the Clinton administration. And he said, sure, we did do political briefings for cabinet members and occasionally one or two of their top aides. But the difference in this White House is the effort to transmit campaign information, political polling, references to specific tight races, not just to a couple of people into a cabinet agency, but in the case of the Interior Department and other, and now there's just been a congressional hearing on the General Services Administration, not just to one or two political appointees, but to the entire managerial staff. They are political appointees, and apparently these briefings were cleared by White House lawyers. But the question is introducing specific electoral concerns to a large group of federal agency managers, highlighting for them which races are important. That seems to be something quite different. And as you pointed out in this hearing before Congressman Waxman's Oversight Committee a couple of weeks ago, Loretta Doan, the manager, the director of the General Services Administration, was quoted by a couple of those managers who were in the room as saying after the White House PowerPoint presentation was presented where they highlighted close races, she said something to the effect of, let's go out there and support our candidates. Now, she says she can't recall that statement, but there are a couple of employees who've come forward and told Waxman's investigators that that's what's happened. And when that sort of statement follows a presentation like this, it does appear to be, at least according to an analysis Waxman has received from the Congressional Research Service, a breach of the Hatch Act prohibitions. And we think, as reporters watching I've covered a number of administrations now. We think it's something that's different by the matter of degree, but significantly different nonetheless from previous administrations.
Again, I'm speaking with Tom Hamburg, who's an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and he recently broke the story in the LA Times that there are perhaps millions of missing emails in connection with the White House role in this growing U.S. attorney, which is now, I suppose, perhaps into the realm of a scandal. At least there's a certain lot of ink is flying around this story, and it does seem that, and of course, Tuesday of next week, the Attorney General will be testifying in what's expected to be a kind of make or break appearance for him. And prior to that, of course, the emails have been identified that the GOP candidates the replacement candidates were discussed well before the eight were fired. Apparently, Sunday, Senator Specter, the minority head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, has called for the reinstatement at least one of the USAs. I think the Iglesias in New Mexico.
New Mexico, yes.
So this is clearly going on, but I think it's inescapable in this that the subtext in this whole thing surely is this almost obsession on the part of Karl Rove, and I believe it's also shared by President Bush himself, in the notion of a voter fraud, and that was one of the reasons why they felt they had to replace these eight U.S. attorneys, because they weren't sufficiently vigilant in terms of going after voter fraud. And yet we find out that the Justice Department themselves, their five-year investigation provided scant evidence of voter fraud, 86 minor convictions, some of which appear to be pretty trumped up. So what explains this? Is this an extension of what you and Peter Walston wrote about in your book, One Party Country, that there is a kind of a master plan here developed by Rove and others to make the Republicans the permanent majority party, and they're not particularly churlish about being aggressive in terms of well, we all know that the canard that one man's fraud is another man's emancipation.
Yes, well. Ian, I do think that what we're seeing in the use of RNC emails so extensively in the White House, and now the revelations that there were some political undercurrents that explains the firing of at least some of the eight United States attorneys, does reveal part of what was, again, we think unique or close to unique about this administration, which was, what you suggested a moment ago, very intense focus on seeking electoral advantage. You know, Karl Rove is an autodidact and a student of history, and he had a couple of role models who fascinated him. One was Mark Hanna, who served as an advisor to President McKinley, who established an era of Republican dominance after he was elected early in this century, with a coalition of Main Street and large corporate supporters, and also Franklin Roosevelt. Rove looked with some jealousy on the really four decades long era of Democratic dominance that occurred after Roosevelt and the New Deal. And to some extent, he wanted to be, he thought that there was a possibility of building a kind of conservative revolution and offering George W. Bush as a sort of conservative New Dealer, in a way, who could build, if things were organized correctly, and if you could really control the apparatus of the federal government, get the message out there, and continue to build a Republican majority, that you could sustain what they called a dominant majority for some decades along the lines of a Roosevelt majority. And I do believe that was, we don't have to have the scary music and sinister tones around it, but it was part of a plan and an organization that's part of this administration, and that explains, I think, part of the reason why you see interference down to the level of the discussion about the U.S. attorneys, and to a degree we haven't seen before, how their activities might help or hinder Republican candidates.
And it's no coincidence, I guess, that the states that these attorneys come from are states that will be in play in 08, and that's the implication. But what you just said there in terms of the historical record, Tom Hamburger, vis-a-vis Rove's role models, Mark Hanna, of course, I mean, his influence went away because the accidental president, Teddy Roosevelt, after McKinley was shot, was a man of virtue. and he cleaned up Dodge. And the FDR's majority that had a lot to do with the way he handled the Depression and World War II. What we're talking about here is somewhat, it's not about the extent of your popularity and your popular vote and the extent to which you have real political following in this country. It's a question of how you shave the margins and how you make sure your guys vote and the other guys don't vote.
Yep. And I would add one thing. You just talked about the GSA, the PowerPoint presentation that was made by the White House Political Office to cabinet agencies and to the GSA earlier this year. One of the explanations for the Republican defeat that is sort of is repeated over and again in the PowerPoint is the issue of corruption, which was, I think Republicans believe, perhaps unfairly associated with the Republican Party, and it hurt them. One could then take the next step and say, well, what would be the best way to turn around the perception of GOP corruption than if you could, if there were more corruption cases brought against Democrats? And we now know that in the case of the firing of at least one of the U.S. attorneys, Iglesias of New Mexico, that there was some pressure coming from Republican lawmakers and Republican Party figures in New Mexico to encourage investigation of Democratic Party corruption in New Mexico, and some frustration that Iglesias had not brought these cases before the election.
Well, there was the example, though, of where that strategy was successful. It didn't ultimately result in the Republicans winning the seat in New Jersey, but they did throw a frivolous suit against Menendez, and then it just disappeared after the elections. And that's apparently a game plan that Rove worked out when he was down in Texas.
I don't know whether that was the Menendez charges, whether it's correct to say that they're frivolous or not, but you are correct to say that this is the sort of thing that is sort of right out of the Rove playbook, that those of us who've studied his biography and his tactics through the years might expect. And there was a case where we know in New Mexico there was a very, very close House race decided by less than 2,000 votes involving Congresswoman Heather Wilson. And one of the thoughts was that that very tight race might be decided and her condition improved in the race if the corruption charges against Democrats were in fact brought.
So where do you think this is heading, Tom Hamburger, given that that effectively that this leading Democratic senator, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, is more or less calling the the White House liars? He's not buying their excuses, and he's piling on the references to Watergate of flying thick and fast. The RNC basically aren't subject to the same laws as the White House are, but if indeed forensically these things can be recovered, do you expect the 5 million missing, if that's indeed, I know the public interest group in Washington came up with that figure, but that seems an extraordinary figure.
The Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics. Right. Now, there are a couple of times when emails were lost. The first, and the one where millions may have been lost, is when the White House converted from, I think, a Lotus Notes system to a Microsoft Outlook system, and there was some kind of hiccup, which was discovered in the course, I believe, of the Fitzgerald investigation, and investigated more thoroughly by this crew organization that you just mentioned. And there were apparently some emails going back to the 2002-2003 period which were missing from that conversion. We're not sure of the exact number. The crew has said 5 million. And we're not sure how many of those can be recovered. Then there's a second group of emails that has to do with official business conducted on the Republican National Committee accounts that were not saved in accord with the Presidential Records Act. And the RNC's lawyer, who we interviewed on Friday, said, "Well, it's not we're the Republican National Committee, not the White House. It's not our job to preserve these." And indeed, White House rules and the employee's manual says if you conduct official business regardless of which email account you use, it's your responsibility, you being the White House employee, to save it, print it out, and also send it to your White House official account, and it will automatically be preserved. You mentioned, Ian, a moment ago, the comments of the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Leahy, who has been quite aggressive in saying, we want to get to the bottom of this. We want to know about the missing emails. We would like to jointly investigate the Republican National Committee accounts to see to recover the missing emails that have to do with the U.S. attorney's firings. But I'd say that politically at the moment, perhaps the more interesting and signal comments came from Republicans this morning on the talk shows. Senator Spector and Senator Lindsey Graham, both members, Republican members of the Judiciary Committee, said Alberto Gonzalez has, as Lindsey described it, an uphill struggle to reestablish his credibility. Senator Spector, the ranking member of that committee, went even further and said that Gonzalez should consider an apology and maybe even reinstating some of these fired U.S. attorneys, unless he can explain or justify their dismissal, which he feels so far has not been been done. So I think the fact that you've got Republicans on this committee pursuing and interested, concerned about this U.S. attorney case so aggressively is a difficult sign for Mr. Gonzalez this week as he goes before them and for the White House.
Well, the story that you've been breaking this week, yes, and that obviously there's more to come in the following weeks, we still have to go back and add to that the fact that the first batch of documents that were given to the Judiciary Committee were heavily edited and redacted and whited, yes, out, and now they've given them replacement documents. So it's a little wonder there's a skepticism, shall we say, on the part of the committee.
Yes, and I think you're seeing Republicans now, Republicans joining the Democrats in the request,
right,
for a thorough investigation here.
Right.
And it will blunt White House attempts, make it more difficult for the White House to, one, just say that this is a partisan witch hunt. Two, the use of the private emails and, as you suggested, some of what appears to be at least hiding, not disclosing all the information at the front end, will make it harder for the White House to claim executive privilege to shield access to some of these documents and to testimony of people like Karl Rove and former White House counsel Harriet Myers.
If they testify.
If they testify. And that came up also today in discussions with Arlen Specter, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he expected now that there may be some movement there in which Rove will testify, not under oath, but there will be a transcript released of his testimony. He thinks that now may be in the offing, and that's movement as well.
And Fitzgerald's come out and said that the emails were missing between Rove and Stephen Hadley back in 2003. So that could also come back to haunt us all. So
yes, I think we're not sure. Obviously, it's hard to predict because we haven't seen these missing emails yet. But given that Karl Rove, who is so influential, and his staff were making such heavy use of the RNC email accounts, where we know years' worth of emails are missing for the moment, one could suggest that at the least the plot will thicken and that we're going to have sort of a chase and a hunt here for the missing emails, which should prove quite interesting.
And you're going to have a busy week.
I think so.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Tom Hamburger, who is an investigative journalist, reporter with the Los Angeles Times, specializing in the White House and the executive branch, and he broke the story in the LA Times this week that perhaps millions of missing emails have disappeared in connection to the White House's role in the U.S. attorney firings. I'm now speaking with Paul Leonard, who is the California director of the Center for Responsible Lending, which is dedicated to protecting home ownership and family wealth by working to eliminate abusive financial practices. Mr. Leonard has been a long-time advocate for full disclosure, responsibility, and accountability in the lending industry and has long forecasted serious problems in the subprime market, which is now melting down and is expected to affect 400,000 homes in California in foreclosure and 2.4 million in the United States itself nationwide. And we've already had evidence that the meltdown has begun and a couple of subprime lenders have gone, at least one major one's gone into bankruptcy. The head of Countrywide has just quit. AmeriQuest was a, they were also in the, weren't they a leader in this so-called market?
Yes, AmeriQuest was the leading subprime lender in the country until their the state attorney generals, 49 of them, got together, did a major investigation, found a number of serious problems with the practices that were being used, including a really aggressive aggressive marketing, failure to do honest and clear disclosures to borrowers, and which resulted in a $325 million settlement that was reached with AmeriQuest, and their position in the subprime market soon dropped substantially thereafter.
But the founder and head of AmeriQuest, wasn't he up for didn't President Bush put him up for an ambassadorship?
He did, and he is currently serving as an ambassador as we speak. AmeriQuest is a company that has sort of a serious kind of up and down history in the subprime market. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, there were other serious problems and questions raised. A number of public advocacy and interest groups engaged in an effort to try and get AmeriQuest to clean up its practices. And for a time, they, as a result of that process, they came up with what were then sort of industry best practices. But shortly thereafter, they had an explosive period of growth, and substantial problems reemerged thereafter, resulting in the ultimate settlement procedure with the attorneys general.
Mm-hmm. But aren't we talking about, you know, let's be frank here. We're talking about kind of bottom feeders here, where people who don't qualify for traditional mortgages because they can't put up the sufficient deposit and they don't have a sufficient monthly income to service the debt are beguiled, sometimes conned into attractive offers that postpone real payments, and they basically get people in, collect, and disappear.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would describe it quite that way, but there have been, it is true that the subprime mortgage market has been offering up aggressive push marketing tactics, and there have been huge problems in the products and in the practices that have been present in making mortgage loans to borrowers with imperfect credit. There is that's absolutely without a doubt.
And Paul Leonard, who again is the California director of the Center for Responsible Lending, there is a talk of some legislative effort. Senator Schumer, Dodd have suggested that the feds should step in and stop the hemorrhaging here. Mm-hmm. And there is a fear that as these subprime mortgages melt down, that it could affect the wider housing market and, in fact, the economy at large.
Absolutely. I mean, the subprime market is now represents about 1 in 5 of all mortgage transactions that were that took place in 2005 and in 2006. So it's not a negligent part of the housing market. And while subprime mortgages represent about 13% of all mortgages that are outstanding, they represented about 60% of the foreclosures that occurred last year.
So, I mean, I take it that the real issue is here that if there's a substantial meltdown, this means a lot more property is on the market. This means a general depression of real estate values. And I understand that one of the fears in terms of macroeconomics is that there's been so much cheap money for so long that people have taken out seconds and thirds against their houses, and they're essentially hanging on to the middle class because of the value of their property.
Correct.
Which in many cases is inflated and is vulnerable to a raise in interest rates. And I believe, you can give me the figures, but I think the majority, I think, of mortgage holders in the country have variable mortgages.
Yes. Well, it is correct that there has been a huge growth in the adjustable rate mortgages, particularly here in California, where housing prices have inflated so quickly and so dramatically that borrowers, both in the subprime as well as in the prime market, have turned towards what are called non-traditional mortgages or affordability products, all of which are intended to reduce the initial cost at which people must pay in early in the period of their mortgages, but then bear substantial risk for increasing interest rates at a later date. In the subprime mortgage market, it was particularly the design of the product, the standard product, was particularly problematic. People paid a discounted, although for the subprime market, not very low interest rate, but at say 6 or 7% on average for a fixed period of 2 years, and then faced very large increases in their mortgage payment at the 2-year mark, which by and large was designed to force a refinance as long as housing prices continue to grow. But we are now facing a situation where, as housing markets either flatten or in some cases go negative, we're looking at widespread foreclosures in the subprime market. Our organization put out a report at the end of last year, which you made reference to, which projected that nationwide we would experience 2.2 million foreclosures in the subprime market associated with subprime loans that were originated between 1998 and 2006. And as you noted, more than 460,000 of those foreclosures would occur here in California.
So if you have, if a house on your street goes into foreclosure, mm-hmm. and it's sold in a fire sale, mm-hmm. that's going to affect your property value if you put your house on the market.
Exactly. I mean, that's the great concern in the sort of the broader economic world. There are two. One is that many of these adjustable rates are going to affect not just the subprime market, but those with slightly better credit, but who have used these adjustable rates and stated income features of their loans to get into home ownership situation. And then the second is that foreclosures for subprime borrowers will affect the property values of their neighbors in their communities in a generally negative way. And even as housing prices are now flattening out and in some cases declining, a substantial explosion of foreclosures, even in the subprime market, will lead to a downward cycle in housing prices in the broader marketplace.
And in terms of California, if 460,000 houses go into foreclosure and are dumped on the market, mm-hmm. What percentage is that? That seems like a pretty substantial number.
It's a large percentage, and of course, they're going to be concentrated in certain markets that have experienced the steepest housing price fluctuations, downward fluctuations. So our report showed that the highest foreclosure rates would be actually occurring in the Central Valley of the part of California, and in Sacramento and in San Diego, where housing prices have already begun to drop most significantly.
And in terms of the broader economy, a lot of people are vulnerable to the rise in interest rates, are they not?
Because interest rates have been rising. They've risen steadily since 2002. For those people who are in adjustable rate mortgages, that represents the risk of substantial increases in their mortgage payments. And I think time will tell the extent to which there are going to be substantial kinds of inability to pay higher mortgage payment rates over the next 12 to 24 months as these mortgage payments are likely to reset. There are some important differences between prime and subprime mortgages. The standard subprime mortgage will face a payment adjustment after just 2 years, and then will happen every 6 months thereafter. in the prime market, it's much more common for the adjustments to occur 3 or 5 years later and then to only happen annually. And so the prime market is going to be a little bit more protected from the precipitous increases in mortgage payments that are associated, that have been occurring and have been causing so many significant problems in the subprime market.
But in the broad kind of terms of the economic health of the country, I think it's pretty clear that most people, that your home ownership is your ticket into the middle class.
And it historically has been.
That's right. Correct. So if we have a middle class whose wages have been flat, mm-hmm. which is pretty clear, and we've mm-hmm. lost our manufacturing base, and there's a lot of, outsourcing and downsizing going on in terms of the so-called globalism. But I think it's pretty clear that the wages have been pretty stagnant for some time. The one area of the household income that's out of control appears to be gasoline prices. So isn't it fair to suggest that you've got people out there that are pretty economically stressed to begin with?
Oh, no question about it. Absolutely. There's no question about it, both with gasoline prices and with the mortgage market has been important. The run up in housing prices has been an important source of equity that has maintained higher levels of consumer spending over the last few years. Many believe that houses have become the average family's piggy bank, for which a refinance loan, taking out equity of inflated of housing price appreciation, allows higher than allows people to live a lifestyle that has been higher than what their earnings and their incomes alone would provide.
So when we talked earlier, Paul Leonard, about talk on Capitol Hill to legislate some kind of fix to stop the hemorrhaging so that we don't have this meltdown.
Yeah.
But I guess the important thing here is, where does this federal money, and I'm not even sure, I don't know how the feds can come up with any more money. They just keep
right.
throwing money at Iraq and it just goes down a hole. And we know that the federal borrowing is in the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. But assuming that they can always borrow more, your concern is that they don't bail out the lenders, they bail out the borrowers.
That's correct. The best outcome would be for folks who are facing mortgages that they cannot afford to repay at a higher payment rate, but have had a good record of payment for the first several years of their mortgage. We are really trying to urge the lenders and the investors who are now own these securities that are backed by these mortgages to modify the loans to allow people to continue to pay an affordable fixed rate loan, converting that loan, not forcing the payment reset to increase the mortgage payment, keeping the mortgage payment affordable, and converting it to a long-term fixed-rate loan that would allow the homeowners to remain in their home and without it facing the risk of foreclosure, that would maximize some continued level of flow of payments to the lenders and the investors who are counting on those payments without the substantial disruption that widespread foreclosures would require, and without a substantial federal investment of new federal funds that would essentially refinance mortgages, make the lenders and the investors whole for the mortgages that they've provided, many which were provided on very abusive terms to start out with. Mm-hmm. And so the best outcome would be some process for ensuring that lenders, investors would modify the loans without requiring a full-scale refinance, and which wouldn't require a large federal investment.
Well, that's what I was referring to when I referred to the sort of bottom feeding mm-hmm. nature of this predatory capitalism, and I don't know how widespread it is. I don't know how you in fact pass it out, because obviously the defenders of subprime have said, well, you know, people who normally couldn't get into the middle class at least have gotten in there, but it seems that the price they paid to getting in there is pretty onerous.
Well, that's true. I mean, we need to be very careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Providing access to credit for families that have imperfect credit records continues to remain an important priority, but the terms of that credit needs to be fair and reasonable. And that what's happened is that we have seen really abusive practices, really, that have become widespread in the subprime market through the design and the marketing of these products. And rather than providing terms to fairly priced credit that accounts for the fact that people who have imperfect credit are likely to be somewhat more riskier borrowers.
Well, I guess we should hold our breath here, particularly in the state of California.
There are states that have already experienced far sharper declines in their housing prices, and therefore even much greater, on a sort of a percentage basis, experience with foreclosures. Mm-hmm. Ohio and Colorado come immediately to mind. But our report certainly indicated that the biggest problems were going to occur in the states that have had the biggest run-ups, including here in California.
That's true. You can buy a mansion in the Midwest for what you could get a small bungalow here in California for.
Absolutely.
I thank you so much for joining us here, Paul Leonard.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Paul Leonard, who's the director of the Center for Responsible Lending here in California. And I'm now joined in the studio by Dr. Richard Malika, who is a Harvard Medical School professor of psychiatry and the director of the Harvard Program in Refugee Trauma at the Massachusetts General Hospital. He holds an M.A.R. from Yale Divinity School and is a Fulbright New Century Scholar, the recipient of many honors and awards, including the APA Human Rights Award. His new book is Healing Invisible Wounds, Paths to Hope and Recovery in a Violent World. And it seems to me that just in terms of torture being in the news, regrettably, for some time, and we all know that the United States has taken a black eye in terms of its standing as the Constitution says, decent respect for the opinions of mankind. The opinions of mankind have turned against us as a country when we were held to a higher standard. It seems that we've lost a lot. And have we gained anything? I mean, is there anything? Is there any evidence that we've ever gained anything in terms of intelligence? In other words, the reason we've lowered our standards and affected our reputation in the world is to get actionable intelligence. It seems to me we've got nothing but actionable lawsuits.
Well, I began our program in 1981. And just to give you a brief history, in 1981, the word refugee, human rights, torture, all these things were not known by the American public and were definitely not taken up in any medical school in the United States. When I was at Yale in the 70s, I had one one-hour lecture on rape trauma in 5 years. One one-hour lecture. And there's been a revolution in the understanding and the care of victims of extreme violence over the past 25 years. And I talk about this in the book. And Americans have been on the forefront of this. So I think that you always have the problem of the relationship between the personal healing and social healing, and even the meaning of social healing politically. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So what I say in my book that it's clear that in the past 25 years, we've demonstrated that victims of extreme violence and torture can be identified, treated, and recover. But then when you move towards the social level, you have a lot of problems. And it's at the social level, there's a fiction that there's no relationship between social healing and personal healing. In fact, I say in the book, it's not only a fiction, it's a lie. There are political reasons why we don't believe, or we tell people there's no relationship between personal healing and social healing, whether you're talking about Bosnia, Middle East, United States, 9/11, or whatever. So this is a very complicated area because we've made very little progress, and maybe the United States has gone actually backwards on the whole issue of social healing in relationship to extreme violence, you see. But at the grassroots level, Congress, you know, has a program in the United States where a significant amount of money is given to 30 centers in the United States, including one important one here in Los Angeles, to care for survivors of torture. So these are the contradictions within the American context today, Sue.
Well, I guess I'm sort of framing this in terms of responsibility. You know, here we are living in a basically pretty blessed land compared to the rest of the world. But on the other hand, much of what went on during the Cold War were surrogate wars where we and the Russians were fighting each other through the misery of some third world country. And you said you started in 81. I mean, so much of the work that you've done and so much of what we know about have come from countries where we had a clandestine relationship with the bad guys, from Chile, from Argentina, from El Salvador. And now this clandestine relationship the CIA were in the same room as the torturers, but not actually torturing them, now has sort of exploded in our face. We have the rendition program has been exposed, and the very fact that Americans have directly participated in torture, of course, as I think, is a new thing. It may have been happening in a clandestine way, but now it's happening in a public way. So, when you talk about social healing, where does responsibility begin?
Well, let's look at it two ways. I look at it two ways. One is that we used to think that torture was exotica. In other words, it happened in Bosnia. It happened in Rwanda. You understand what I'm saying? Those are not American people. And a big revolution has occurred is that the study of extreme violence has really clued us in to the basic principles of human abuse and the health and mental health impact of violence in our own country and in other countries related to domestic violence, youth violence, treatment of our Iraqi soldiers coming back from the war, etc. I wrote an op-ed on this recently about the Iraqi veterans, you know. All around a kernel of idea around humiliation, because torture is what we've learned is torture. The main instrument of torture is humiliation. People use humiliation to achieve their goal. And in using humiliation, it's usually humiliation that is there to annihilate the individual, their family, and their culture. Okay. It's not bad people just doing bad things to people, other people who they don't know.
So you don't think it has anything to do with gathering intelligence then?
I think that if you look at almost every situation of torture, there's a utopian dream lurking behind that, whether you're looking at Pol Pot or Rwanda, Milosevic. Every situation has is framed within a bigger utopian dream, you know, cleansing, purifying, national security, making a better society, the war on terror, whatever you want to call it. And so it becomes very clear that people use these big social dreams to hurt other people through torture. And the problem for the victim is that the victim also sometimes feels that the purpose of the torture is actually a good purpose because they feel that they've participated in class inequality or other kinds of problems in which they buy into, they often buy into the worldview of the torturer. So when I work with my patients, the first thing I say to them, I say, look, you got to understand that whatever you think about torture, no one had the right to torture you. This is over the top. This is too much. And you have to begin with that because a lot of people accept torture as a good thing, as something they deserved on some level.
Well, but that's what's often referred to as the Stockholm syndrome, isn't it? That the victim identifies with the victimizer. And are you saying that that's
very common? Across the board. A rich person in Cambodia who saw the class inequality and listened to Pol Pot and then were tortured under the Pol Khmer Rouge, feels on some deep level that they were getting that their punishment was just. So you have to understand, you have to deal with
this.
The
fact that they lived was pretty unusual, right?
But you have to deal with this in every case because people are not clear that they did not deserve to be tortured. I had a wonderful experience with people from the Innocence Project. You know, people who were put in jail, average of 15 to 30 years, and they were innocent. And then the DNA and evidence proved they're innocent, the exonerees, they're called. And I met with these people recently. We were talking about torture. They felt they were tortured. And we were talking about healing and the healing experience. And, you know, they said, look, some cases I was involved in petty crimes. You know, I was doing burglaries, but doesn't mean I should be in jail for 30 years for a multiple rape trauma, you know. So it's a very complicated situation. Mm. And
well, what about the increasing acceptance of torture in our popular culture? I refer to the Fox TV show 24, this idea that torture, as long as there's a ticking time bomb.
The ticking time bomb.
Yeah, and this is what Dershowitz and these other apologists for torture say, that it's, you know, to save a city from a nuclear attack, which is largely in the realm of screenplays so far, is somehow worth lowering your moral standards.
Yeah. Let's backtrack from this, though. The use of violence as entertainment, I mean, video games, kids playing Columbine video games where they can kill their own schoolmates, you know, the massive violence on the radio and television and movies, you know, and you can run through the whole thing. There is the way many TV programs and news programs report on 9/11, on Katrina. Katrina was a good example where African Americans were floating in a bathtub down the flooded street, and they had a 30-second mic put in front of them for 1 minute to tell their story, right? And so there's been a focus. If you look at the phenomenology of the trauma story, I talk a lot in my book about the trauma story. The brutal facts that generate high emotion, you know, arousal, high emotional arousal in the listener is where we're at today. And this whole situation has been a perversion, a complete perversion of the trauma story, because you don't get deeper, you don't drill down deeper into really what's going on in the case of the person. And what I talk about is, and I've criticized the press for this, you know, why isn't, when we hear that a father has lost their son in Iraq, that we don't hear how that family is coping with that situation? With Walter Reed scandal, why is it that we hear a young man has been disabled in a certain situation that we don't hear the full story, the full trauma story of the soldier, you know? And so there's been a collusion among many, many, many people to use extreme violence as a form of entertainment. And I think this has been extremely destructive. These torture programs, as a, you know, there was a...
So who's the villain here? Because it's all over TV. It's all over video games. We know we have this peculiar moralistic strain in the country that thinks, you know, showing somebody's breast is worse than showing somebody's head being blown off. But it seems to me that that much of this pornography and violence is driven by rampant capitalism.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. And I'll give you a small example. After 9/11, the city of New York, through Columbia University, asked for a study of the high school students in New York City. And they discovered that the kids came from very violent situations prior to 9/11, and that most of their psychiatric impairment was due to violence in their community. We chose at that time not even to address that. We chose not even to address. So when you hear youth violence right now in Los Angeles, Boston, et cetera, there's an enormous amount of violence going on in our cities, which we choose to ignore. And that is why there's been this perversion around the torture situation, see.
I thank you for joining us here in the studio, Dr. Richard Maliki. I'm sorry we ran out of time because this is a subject that's going to haunt us for some time. And I thank you also for your book, Healing Invisible Wounds, Path to Hope and Recovery in a Violent World.
Well, thank you very much. Honored to be here. Thank you.
And hello again, Avian Masters. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Rusty Wynn, the assistant producer, Elliot Fong, and Tamika Zoki, the engineer.